This is Debbie Q, and you're listening to The Right Show. The Right Show is a podcast about the strange and unusual, especially in references to death. Mostly true crime, but there is a few odds and ends around here. And my next story is an interesting one, and it has to do with Joey Coyle. He was somebody that, as I was growing up, I had always heard that name consistently, like a folk hero of sorts, but I didn't know why. There was a movie made about it, and it starred John Cusack. It was called Money for Nothing. I have read Finders Keepers by Mark Bowden. That's a really good, if you want to get into the nooks and crannies of this, it's not so much a mystery, more of a tragic tale of rags to riches to rags. I like this one, and he's a Philly boy, and that's why he deserves a number on this podcast, Joey Coyle. Okay, so if we get to his life, Joey Coyle was born on February 26, 1953. Now, he was born and raised in South Philly. Now, South Philly, as we know it, is one, I mean, it's my particular favorite of the city, but because I grew up there. I was born there, and then I grew up a little bit tiny there, and then my mom instantly moved us, before my sister was born, to Northeast Philly because she didn't want to be raised in this tiny little house. And at the time, South Philly did have these tiny houses for longshoremen that would come home for the weekend. You know, they just needed a little bit. Some of these houses don't even have doors and closets in them to this day. It was definitely different. So when they started building, and they built in the Northeast, they built more luxurious homes. I remember when I first started hanging with people from Kensington, which is in the middle of the Northeast and South Philly. I always pictured I-95, and I always picture their exits. You got Academy, then Cottman, then Bridge, Aramingo, Allegheny, Girard, which is closed right now, Yellow Hill. And then you start getting down there, and that's when you hit South Philly. That's when you hit, like, the Washington exits. And it used to be, I don't know what you want to call it now. It was Delaware Avenue. Then it was Christopher Columbus Boulevard, but nobody ever called it that. I still call it Delaware. So I don't know what it's called. I'll call it Delaware until the day I die. So on Delaware Avenue, that's that whole South Philly. That's when you get towards it. And then if you get inside there, that's like Queen Village. That's where I was born. It was at 2nd and Catherine. It was this huge, this was different. This was one of the larger houses. When you walked in, oh my gosh, my aunt had the coolest house. You'd go to, there was like a vestibule, and then you would go to these beautiful doors with these like almost, I can't even explain the doorknob handles. They were like made of glass, iridescent colors. Very cool. You'd open it. There was the living room. Then you'd go through to the kitchen, or you could go upstairs. And if you went a little bit upstairs, it was my great grandmom's room. And then if you went to the left, to the more upstairs, that was my Aunt Mamie. And Mamie always told me she hated me and she wanted me to scrub a roof. I don't know, she was not that much of a child lover. But my other aunt was a child lover, so, you know, we had a whole lot of fun in that house regardless. I think my aunt was the only kid anyway. She secretly loved me. But regardless, that was, and then my dad had grown up 218 Watkins Street. And that's a tiny house. But back then, you know, it was all you needed. It was just him, my grandmother, my grandfather, and they were in that little house on, he always says 2 Street. But, well, that was at 2nd and Catherine. But anyway, South Philly has much meaning to me, and I'm babbling more about my meaning than what the story's about. Except I did want to say that if you go to 9th Street, back in the day, 9th Street was the Italian market. It still is, but it's not the same. You could get anything, anything you wanted. My grandmother used to go down and get like ducks and make this chanina, and it was like duck's blood soup, all kinds of stuff. Me and my dad would still go there until he passed away last year. Unfortunately, his year anniversary is coming up, and I don't want to think about it at all. So, South Philly is like where, when he was growing up, it was all about the corners. All the guys hung on the corner. it was it, what you saw in Rocky. I know it was supposed to be about Kensington, or he supposedly lived in Kensington, but it was so much, to me, it always seems so more South Philly to me. He should have made it South Philly, but regardless, that's what reminds me of South Philly, Rocky. And plus the way people were so close back then, all the grandmoms would come and wash the marble, the steps were marble, they would wash the steps on the weekends, and everyone was for each other's neighbor. And South Philly still is like that in a way. I always like going down there. I always have fun. And I went down there last year and I got my hair cut at a hair cutter, and there was this really cool chick there, and I wish I could remember. Well, I do remember her name and where she is. Perhaps I'll go down there again. But she was cool. She was everyone's just like you would expect, like that Goomba, how you doing kind of way. So here we come to Joey Coyle, and he was from South Philly. He lived with his mother, but I get the impression he drove his mother insane. So she moved in with the sister, Ellen. And he felt guilt. He felt guilt about his dad just dying. He felt guilt because his mom moved out of the house. Joey wasn't going through a good time in 1981. He was not doing well. And to get into the looks of Joey, he was here. The pictures that I have for the website are so South Philly. I mean, he had like the collars always turned up on whatever you're wearing. He had blonde hair. He was cute. I think he was a good looking guy from what I can see. I know a lot of people that knew him personally. I was too young. He had a prominent scar. It went from his eye to down by his ear. They said that he had gotten into a fight because in South Philly and in Kensington, the streets are so narrow, and there's only enough for, like, usually the cars are parked on one side, and on the other side, the cars are, like, up on the sidewalk park. You always have to have your, when I lived on those kind of streets, I'm telling you, I went through more broken mirrors because people just come flying down and knock all your mirrors off. It's constant. And until they started making the mirrors that folded in, it was a real disaster. So regardless, there's only one lane and it's a tight lane. I couldn't even get my van down some of the streets. Anyway, his car broke down. Joey's car broke down at the head of one of these streets. And I guess somebody, they said, who didn't know that, you know, that's just how it goes in Philly, came up, they got into an argument, and then he sliced Joey's eye down to his cheek, and that's how he got that prominent scar. And it was always there, like this gray scar. It did kind of mess with his face a little, but he still was cute, you know? He had that certain something about him. And they said he was like your standard good guy, like blue collar worker. I mean, I feel bad because I have sympathy for Joey, because what truly was wrong was Joey was a massive drug addict. He had to do meth, which he called blow. I always heard that term for coke, but whatever, he called it blow. He would shoot it up like every hour. And on this one morning, he was really feeling like, if I think a couple hours had went by and he didn't have his fix, and it must have been like going on some time, then he told his two friends, Jed and John, to let's get into that 71 Chevy Malibu and drive it around. He wanted to get some meth. So, and meth was a huge deal. I mean, when I was 16, it was all over the place. There was this purple meth that was just all the rage back then. They go into the car and they're driving past Swanson and Wolf, and Joey had went to his dealer's house to get meth, and he didn't have it, or he wasn't there yet, so he was really bumming. So he said, let's just drive around and look for stuff. Now, I've always noticed this to be a big thing. I notice every guy, and this could be every guy, period. I don't think this is a Philly thing, but it's hilarious that they tend to always look at the ground and find stuff. My friend Terry has found probably thousands of dollars over the years from just finding 20s on the ground here and there. He always is looking on the ground. And I'm always like, why are you looking on the ground? But it makes sense because this is how Joey found this huge yellow tub with wheels on it. He didn't know what it said at first, but he was thinking that it might be a good toolbox. He jumps out of the car and he sees that on the other side, on black letters, it says Federal Reserve Bank. Well, he is flipping out. He knows there's money in there. They all start screaming, him and his two friends, John and Jed, and they freak out and bring the thing home. Joey is very much the guy who, he wants to do the right thing, even if he's a little mixed up here and there. His sister, she just said he was always a certain way. He was like the big lovable kook, you know, and that's just what he was. He tried, you know, he tried to do the right thing. But at this instance, he was going to take, it was finders keepers for Joey Coyle. Inside this huge container marked Federal Reserve Bank was actually $1.2 million. Right off the bat, what would you do if you were just driving around, you saw this huge container, just picked it up, put it in your car, and there was two other people with you, and you found out it was $1.2 million? Well, right then and there, of course, you're going to get nervous because you're going to be like, there's two other people. And what's the secret? It's only good when two people are involved and the other person is dead. Otherwise, it's a mess. And that's kind of what happened from the beginning here. Had Joey just found it? I don't know. I think it would have still ended up crazy because of his nature. So he goes and his friend named Carl Massey, he was an older gentleman. He had been sick for a while and he didn't know much time he had left. So I think he had taken Joey under his wing somewhat. So Joey actually thought of Carl Massey first. Let me get it to Carl's house. He'll know what to do. That was like his older compadre, you know, somebody he looked up to. He wanted to be steering right in this instance. They go to his house. He brings up the money. Carl Massey, until the day he died, which was a lot longer than he thought, there was a mobster named Sonny Riccobini, and he was brothers with the high-ranking Harry the Hunchback Riccobini. So they had called Sonny over to figure out what to do with this money. Now, to the end of days, they said, what the hell are you talking about? Sonny would have never been in my house. Those kids don't even know what he looks like. This was from Carl Massey. He just claimed that this part never happened. Erase it from your memories after I tell it. Because I think this probably did happen. It just goes in line with the story. But who am I? So Sonny came over and his thought was to start laundering it through the casinos. He told Joey to give him some of the money. Joey's trying to do the right thing, splitting it. He's giving some to Sonny Riccobini, some to Carl Massey, holding some for himself, giving some to John and Jed to shut them up because his friends, John and Jed, were getting very nervous. Especially when, like, Detective Pat Lorenzi, he had already been getting pieces in his ear, so to speak, that the money was picked up by somebody driving this 1971 Chevy Malibu. So they were already looking for that. Joey knew that. He wanted to get rid of the car. John, his friend, was beside himself. He's like, that's my dad's car. Joey kept saying, dude, we'll buy him three cars. Like, who cares? We got all this money. Just shut up. But again, when all those people are involved, it becomes a mess. And not to mention that Joey was doing so much meth at this point. He was probably, well, I mean, when you are an addict like that, you're really doing it not to be sick at a certain point. But still, if you're doing so much all the time, I'm sure he was like off the charts, you know. He's probably speeding his brains out. Regardless, he got his girlfriend, Linda Reuter, and they just went to hotels and had sex and did meth and had a blast for a couple days before this all came to a screeching halt. In the meantime, word around town was that this $1.2 million had been snapped up by somebody and everybody was going crazy. There was articles in the Daily News and the Inquirer, and I'm sure the Bulletin, I think the Bulletin was still out then. Yeah. Oh no, maybe it wasn't. But anyway, the major newspapers were all clamoring, saying, oh, what would you do with the money? And it became this huge deal, much bigger than I think Joey had thought initially. This was everybody I have ever talked to, like my dad, but I, like I said, I've always heard the name Joey Coyle. I didn't know what it was a reference to for a long time. Apparently, this money had come from casino earnings, and they were virtually untraceable. So that was even more why people were like, you know, my dad was always like, you just take a little bit at a time and nobody would have ever noticed that. They came up with that $50,000 reward, I think a minute too late, because Joey was already like, this is finders keepers. My dad gave this to me from heaven. This was a gift from God. He truly, genuinely believed that. Nobody could talk him out of it. And he had already gotten Sonny Riccobini, allegedly, involved with laundering. But the speed, or just who knows what kicks in? Is it how you feel? Is it the meth? Is it just pure, your conscience gets the better of you? He was really going through a lot, and it was making him more and more nervous about what was going to happen with this money. And in the meantime, the police were gaining on him anyway, because his friend John had called the police. Everyone was nervous, and I think when they saw the mob getting in on it, they were even more nervous. So the police almost immediately had, through confessions, that it was wanted Joey Coyle, 28-year-old white male, date of birth 2/22/53, Front Street, Philadelphia, dirty blonde hair, tattoo on one arm of shamrock, scar on one side of his face from ear to below eye, wanted for theft. Now, so Joey said he was going to get out of town and this guy Frank Santos was going to help him. Where he was going or why this would have stopped anything, I don't know. And it was such a mess at this point. Everyone, when he had stopped with those two other kids, they told people and he had told everybody. And also, it is legendary that Joey was giving like homeless people $100 bills. He was just throwing the money around. People knew. He could not keep his mouth shut. People knew where this money was. And again, they had called the police. They were in on it. So they had this APB out on Joey, and they catch a Joey Coyle in a bar brawl in New Jersey, but it wasn't the right Joey Coyle. He had called up his friend in the meantime, Frank Santos. It wasn't like a friend, it was someone he kind of messed with a lot, but Frank Santos would do anything to help him. They went up to New York. Joey was going to take an airplane into Acapulco. And he at first tried to put on pantyhose and stuff all the money. He had like $100,000 taped to his ankles. And he tried to put on pantyhose, but he was so freaked out thinking, if something happens and they see me in pantyhose, I'll die. So he took off the pantyhose. He continued to tape his ankles with this $100,000. Him and Frank Santos have this hilarious ride through New York City. Again, if you're looking to read the entire script of this, there is a great book called Finders Keepers by Mark Bowden. It's hilarious. I know there's a movie, and that's Money for Nothing with John Cusack. Now, what happened was, when the movie was going to be made, there was like several hands in the pot. Disney had it. They wanted it to be like this funny comedy. There was a guy named Ramon Menendez. He wanted to make it a dark story where he did involve Joey's drug use. Disney did not want the drug use in it. So the movie just, because they said what happened, because they were fighting creatively, it wasn't funny enough for Disney. It wasn't dark enough for Menendez, so they just scrapped it altogether. They didn't care about it, and it stinks, because it's a good movie, but it's just not accurate. It's not an accurate portrayal of what happened, or of Joey, really. But I love John Cusack, so it wasn't any fault of his. I would suggest reading the book before seeing the movie, only because it's just more accurate. And it is hilarious, them going through New York. They get to the airline, and the FBI is there. They finally, because when they got the guy in the street brawl in New Jersey, everything was okay. The tattoos, the blonde hair, and Also, Joey had dyed his hair a little bit, so it wasn't as blonde as it normally was. But that scar is unmistakable. When they got the guy in Jersey and the scar wasn't there, they realized it wasn't the real Joey Coyle. When the FBI got him in the airport going to Acapulco, they knew it was him because of the scar. Bing, bam, it was there. So he gets arrested. And that's what it came down to. I mean, I think Joey felt relief. Because I don't think he can handle the pressure. I know it seems like a great thing when you find $1.2 million, that's got to be this awesome high. But then the reality sets in. If it's not yours, and I'll say this time and time again, because it's the truth. When you're given something that's either not yours or you didn't work for it, there's no meaning behind it. That's why people with immediate gratification and I want, it's just not, I'm telling you, there's something to be said for the simpler things in life. Those are the most beautiful things that you treasure when you've either earned it or it's yours. You know, it's not something that you're worried about. Anything that involves like crime and stuff. Look at how many people kill themselves after they've committed a crime or have done something that is wrong. I know people do it for other reasons, but I'm just saying there's a lot to be said for earning things and working for things. Genuinely, something is yours when it's yours, no doubt. And I think that's what bothered Joey. Like, in the back of his mind, he knew that his dad wouldn't have been proud of him. He knew that his mom, who was soon to pass away, and it really would destroy him. It really doesn't work. So Joey felt relieved, and they took him in. Now, of course, he gets out on bail, and they're waiting for the trial, and he was probably a nervous wreck, probably doing meth out the wazoo with this Linda Reuter girl. And, I mean, that seemed to be his girlfriend back then. Further towards the movie, it would be a Tish Canowell, because, unfortunately, Linda would die of an overdose in between the getting caught and the movie, which he got caught, I think, 1981, and the movie was 1993. So there was a long span. Regardless, that's just something that stuck in my head. It was a shame that she didn't make it. So he was worried about the trial, and he should be, because there was a young district attorney named Robert Casey. Now, Robert Casey was like this uptight, I don't want to say uptight. He was like the very professional, did not accept the ne'er-do-well Joey of doing this kind of thing. Like, he was the, you know, the guy with the stick in his butt, so to speak, that all prosecutors seem to look. When you look at a trial, you can see there's that prosecutorial way is always so out to kill the world, where the defense always seems like laid back, cool. It just seems for this kind of a thing. And that's exactly what happened here. Robert Casey wanted Joey to pay for what he had done. He had stolen money that wasn't his. And his attorney, Harold Kane, who was like this short, cocky guy and he had a Philadelphia accent. So it helps, and it helps people to relate to him. So they were having huge problems because, first of all, Casey wanted Joey's drug use to be known. And Kane was like, his attorney was like, absolutely not. I don't want his drug use involved. And I have to say, the judge sounded like he was on Kane's side, because he did not allow the drug use to be admitted into it. So every time Kane tried to get into it about the drugs, he would say objection, and it would be sustained. It was very rare that the judge overruled it. And that only helped Joey. The few people that came, I mean, everyone had kind of come to his defense. First, the jury selection was a disaster. Now, I don't know how, today it's a little different because people do get paid when they're off of work for jury duty. So some people want to go on jury duty. Back then, I don't think many people got paid, and you literally get like $9 a day. So nobody ever wanted to be on jury duty. And even when I was a kid, I mean, you get called for jury duty all the time in Philadelphia. If you are a registered voter, you will constantly, I must get 4 a year. And I always go to them because I don't mind. And I actually would like to serve on a jury. I did one time, and It was okay, you know. But regardless, I, you know, back then, people just didn't want to be a part of the jury. So you can tell, like, in the transcripts of them asking the jurors questions, they're like, well, I just have a preconceived notion of Joey already. I have a preconceived notion of what should have been done with the money. I can't, you know. So they couldn't keep those people. They took them a couple days before they got a jury together. Now, Frank Santos, the guy that took in New York, took the stand. He, even his friend Frank, like, said, oh my God, Joey was behaving like a child, like he was just out of his mind. And they kept using terms like that. Everybody that came up, Frank Santos, his friend John, everybody that was approached, and Casey, the prosecutor, tried to make it look like Joey was just this theft happy individual. They were like, no, he was gone nuts. He was just out of his mind. And they kept using terms like that. Casey wanted it to be known that he was a drug addict so that they could say, well, that's why he was acting so crazy. He was on drugs. But first of all, Joey had been doing meth for so long. When it's that ingrained in your system, I don't know. I mean, does it make this big difference? You know, it's hard to tell. They couldn't really... The judge was not letting Casey do what he wanted as a prosecutor, which I have to agree with. I don't think the drug use should have came into play. I don't think it even did come into play. Joey was going to do with that money. The same thing would have happened. He would have still taken it. Finders, keepers, losers, weepers. That was Joey's hallmark. That's what he said, and that's how he felt. It was just the stress of all these people involved, and he was worried about the mob, allegedly, and, you know, he was worried about people finding out, and yet at the same time, he was giving the money away and just acting bonkers. So his sister got on the stand and said, yes, he's just acting crazy. His friend Jed, his friend John, Frank, they all took the stand, and the way they had portrayed Joey was he was just like a kid in a candy store. He was jumping up and down. He was crazed, and that's what they kept saying. Again and again, he kept saying, did you see him on the influence of drugs? Finally, when Casey did ask Linda Reuter, his girlfriend at the time, about the drugs, but it was at the end of the testimony, and it didn't seem like it had that much effect by that point. The only thing that might have had an effect then, and I guess the judge was kind of looking out for Joey, was Joey fell asleep in the middle of the proceedings, and the judge kind of called a recess, and he said to Harold Kane, his lawyer, like, you better wake your client up. He's snoozing. They're going to think he doesn't give a shit. He woke him up. As I said before, there was $196,000 still missing that was never found, that some people say it was probably laundered through the casino, or it's just, who knows? It could have been just floating around with the way it was given out. Who knows where that money went? I genuinely believe that nobody ever really knew where that 196 went. I don't think Joey hid it. I get the impression that the 196, because they recovered 1 million out of the 1.2 million. They were trying to play sympathy for the Purolator guards by saying, well, Joey got them fired by stealing the money. And Harold Kane, the lawyer, the defense lawyer, was like, no, by not properly locking the doors, those Purolator guards sign their own pink slip, you know. So that's what I mean. When you have a good lawyer, when you have someone who can talk, and this guy seems like he was pretty good for Joey. The jury came out, which this is unusual. He was acquitted by insanity, temporary insanity, which is pretty crazy. And then in true Joey fashion, he was arrested for meth possession 8 months later. In fact, this would be increasingly bad. I did read where the author Mark Bowden had said that when he met Joey, because his article, actually, he had made a three-story article in the, I think it was the Philadelphia Inquirer, about Joey's case, and that was what was optioned to Hollywood. That was what was ultimately picked up. So when he met Joey because Joey was not, he did not want anything to do with this movie. He had grown tired of hearing about the money and what people would have done with it and where did the $196,000 go. It really did weigh on him, and he did more and more drugs, and he was in and out of rehab. So Mark said by the time he met him, Gone was like the suave, cute, you know, thin Joey Coyle. It was more like this doughy, bloated character of Joey in the long run. And I the mental stress, and it must have got to him. Again, they wanted to make this movie. Now everyone was all gung-ho in the beginning, so they were trying to get the true story. So they wanted Ellen, they wanted this, and they couldn't. Joey was very hard to talk to at this point. They said he just was all over the place. And his mind wasn't as slick as it used to be. I mean, drugs do mess up your system, your nervous system. And after you do so many, did you ever see there are old drug addicts. Don't be mistaken. I always hear, oh, you never see an old drug addict, but I have. And they don't do so good. Their nerves kind of get the better of them. And you start noticing twitches, or just like he said, their coherent sentences go right out the window. And it's just that way because it's like over time of years and years of drug use. And in the same token, when you stop doing drugs, it takes a long time for them to get out of your system and for you to feel good again. Really good. I had my own battles, and I will tell you, it took me from when I stopped to when I felt like myself again, I would say, God, a good 2 years. There was times where I was climbing the walls. That mental need to escape is always there. You know, now I don't feel that. I really don't. I truly enjoy life as it is, but it took a long time. And that's why it's so hard. It's not as much the physical as the mental. The mental is just awful. So anyway, I think Joey could never get to that point. And I think the constant, once his mother died, I think that was it too. It was a combination of things. His mom dying, the drugs, the money. And so over time, he was almost angry when they approached him because everyone was kind of signing in saying, yeah, this is what happened. So they were given, they gave his sister $20,000 and they said, Joey, we're basically going to make this movie with or without you. And he was so hurt. I think it really put a rift in him and his sister till the end. And again, his girlfriend, Linda Reuter had passed away from an overdose. So he had a new girlfriend, Tish Canowell, and she was by his side, I guess, but in the end, he did get money for the movie, but he kept getting arrested for meth. He was on his 8th arrest, I think, and this was going to be a big one, and he was so fearful of either, because the way they were portraying him in the movie, there was no drugs, and there is no drugs in the movie, Money for Nothing. But the problem is, it's not really an accurate portrayal. Anyway, he was so upset about the drug use coming out or the cops taking the money that he made from the movie to pay for whatever fines he was going to incur from this latest arrest for meth. I just don't think he can handle it. And on August 15th, 1993, about 3 months before the movie came out, Joey Coyle hung himself with an electric cord off his railing inside, which is exactly how my friend Cliff did it. I don't know why that, it seems so awful to me, but that seems to be a common way of hanging yourself. Not that that's good in any means, but that's what Joey did. I remember when it happened. I remember people saying, the rumor was that he hung himself out his window to say F you to all the people that had hurt him. That's what I heard when it happened in 1993. Obviously, that's not what happened, but there were such rumors going around at the time. So he died, and that's really sad. He never, I guess the The pressure was just too much for him. And the drugs, that constant need for drugs. I know that that's hard too. I remember my friend's dad was a paramedic, and he saw a lot of guys hang themselves that were addicted to coke. And I think when you're that addicted, it sucks because you're never off of that roller coaster. So Joey Coyle, that one was for you. I always had a thing for Joey Coyle. I think he's hot thing. Like, it was always, that's a damn shame, you know? Like, I always felt bad for him. And he was a victim of his own circumstances. So that was Joey Coyle. I will be getting pictures on therightshoepodcast.com. Thank you. I got a very lovely letter from someone. I don't know if they want to be named, but she had written an article about Byberry. I should ask her if she wants me to link it. It's actually really good. Byberry is another interesting spot of Philadelphia. And if you want to email me, the link is in therightshoepodcast.com. It's Debbie Q at therightshoepodcast.com. So that's all good. I noticed, though, in the Pipe is the Wise one that I was going to do, and I had forgotten all about it. It was a story about this band. They were a Norwegian death metal band. It was called Mayhem, and they were like the first of its kind. And there was a guy in there named Dead. And now the story is fascinating. He had shot himself, and the guy that found him, I can't recall his name right off the top. You know, they're all those Norwegian names. Like, his name was Pell, but they call him Dead. But this guy, let me look it up just so I can get. I mean, this story was so crazy. Dead was the guy who killed himself. The guy who found him was named Euronymous, and that was like a longtime friend of his. Then a couple of years later, now I thought this guy Varg Vicker, I'm having trouble with these names, Vikerness, I thought he killed Euronymous to avenge Dead's death or something, because here, when he found his friend, when Euronymous found Dead, he like supposedly took pieces of his brain and gave it out as souvenirs, and he was just so fascinated by his death that some people were like, did you have something to do with it? Because he had found him. He had to break into the house to get him. So I was going to do a whole podcast about that. And I still could. I've done a lot of suicides. And it would be after I get through a couple more. Because I have a whole heavy hitter section coming up, which is like the big ones, like the JonBenet's. Because people want to hear that. People want to hear what you think of the bigger stories. And there's always something you learn by going over it again. I do notice that. So that being said, I don't want to say I'm coming up with something and then not get to it for some reason. But the Mayhem one, I regret that I didn't get to that, but I'm going to try to get to that because it is a good story. Keep listening. This is Debbie Q, and you're listening to The Right Shoe.